Today, breaking records again, the market update for the 10th of July 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at the latest market movements, unpick some of the underlying trends, also look at how share broker Robinhood funds itself in the US. As normal, we'll start in the US as it continues to call the shots, then go across to Europe, Asia, and finally we'll come to the Australian market because, as always, we tend to react here rather than lead. The three major US stock indices rallied to record closing highs on Friday as financials and other economically focused sectors rebounded from a sell-off sparked by growth worries earlier in the week. The rally allowed the indices to notch slight gains for the week, which also saw a sharp rally in US treasuries as investors worried that the US economic recovery might be losing steam as the Delta variant of the coronavirus spread globally. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1.3% to 34,870. The S&P 500 gained 1.13% to 4,369, and the NASDAQ composite added 0.98% to 14,701. For the week, the Dow was up 0.2%, and the S&P 500 and NASDAQ each added 0.4%. Financials led sector advances, followed by energy, materials, and industrials. Big banks, including JP Morgan Chase, will kick off the second quarter earnings season next week when they report their results. US 10-year Treasury notes fell on Friday, halting an 8-day price rise, and the move higher in yields sparked a bid in regional banking stocks, with the S&P 500 financial sector jumping 2.9% in the sector's biggest daily percentage gain since March the 1st. What an about face from all of the gloom and doom from yesterday, said. What an about face from all of the gloom and doom from yesterday, said Jake Dollarhide, Chief Executive Officer of Longbow Asset Management in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The US is in a bubble compared to the rest of the world, in a break from COVID. How long that's going to last, we don't know, he said. But until that narrative changes, this is a market with a lot of free money and low interest rates. State Street, Capital One Financial Corporation, and Synchrony Financials were all up by more than 4%, and they were the biggest gainers. High interest rates boost the return on interest that banks earn from their loan products, or net interest margin, the difference between the interest income generated by banks and the amount of interest paid out to depositors. A big jump in quarterly earnings is expected to mark a peak for US profit growth in the recovery from last year's pandemic-induced collapse. Investors are looking to US companies' upcoming quarterly results and forecasts about the recovery in the second half of 2021, as some worry that the recent economic surge is already waning. Analysts expect earnings growth of 65.8% for companies in the S&P 500 index in the quarter. That's up from a previous forecast of 54% growth at the start of the period. Wall Street will be watching for any guidance from banks on loan growth for the second half of the year, following softness in the first half amid record consumer savings. Average loan growth will be under pressure in the second quarter, but it's worth paying attention to the end of period loan balances, because if that's above the average, it could foreshadow stronger loan growth in the second half of 21, said an analyst. We expect positive commentary relating to rebuilding loan pipelines to pre-pandemic levels and increased business activity supporting a pickup in loan growth in the second half of 21. Elsewhere among individual stocks, Levi Strauss & Co. rose 1.4% as it forecasts a strong full-year profit after beating quarterly earnings estimates on improving demand across its markets for jeans, tops and jackets. And US-listed shares of Chinese ride-hailing company Didi Global gained 7.3% after four sessions of losses, as it was recently hit by an investigation from China's internet watchdog. President Joe Biden signed a sweeping executive order on Friday to promote more competition in the US economy urging agencies to crack down on anti-competitive practices in sectors from agriculture to drugs and labour. If fully implemented, the effort will help lower Americans' internet costs, allow for airline baggage fee refunds for delayed luggage, among other things. The order instructs antitrust agencies to focus on labour, healthcare, technology and agriculture as they address a laundry list of issues that have irritated consumers and, in the case of drug prices, may have bankrupt some. No more tolerance of abusive actions by monopolies. No more bad mergers that lead to massive layoffs, higher prices, and fewer options for workers and consumers alike, Biden said at a White House signing ceremony. The president noted areas where advocates feel that prices are too high, wages are tamped down, or new businesses are excluded from competition. Let me be very clear. Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation, he said. The White House says the rate of new business formation has fallen by almost 50% since the 1970s, as large businesses make it harder for Americans with good ideas to break into markets. Biden's actions goes after corporate monopolies across a broad swathe of industries and includes 72 initiatives he wants more than a dozen federal agencies to act on. Lower wages caused by lack of competition are estimated to cost the median American household $5,000 per year, according to a White House fact sheet that cites research from the American Economic Liberties Project. That's an influential Washington-based anti-monopoly group. The initiatives will no doubt kick off a series of fights with the affected industries. The powerful U.S. Chamber of Commerce issued a statement saying the move smacks of a government knows best approach to managing the economy and pledged to vigorously oppose calls for government-set prices, onerous and legally questionable rulemakings, efforts to treat innovative industries as public utilities, and the politicization of antitrust enforcement. Among the administration's plans to open up the U.S. economy are new rules to mandate ending excessive internet contract termination fees, allow hearing aids to be sold over the counter, and end non-compete clauses for millions of workers and many occupational licensing requirements. Biden's order pushes the Agricultural Department to act to stop what the White House called abusive practices of some meat processors, reacting to farmers and ranchers who sometimes say they face too few buyers for their animals. And the administration also seeks to make it easier for customers to switch banks and take their transaction data with them, and to restore net neutrality rules that require companies to treat all internet services equally. Now, these range of reforms, if they go through, will touch a wide range of industries, including farm equipment manufacturers, banking, rail, and sea shipping. The executive order will direct the Department of Justice and Federal Trade Commission to carefully review mergers and to challenge prior deals that have closed. And the executive order also establishes a White House Competition Council led by the director of the National Economic Council and includes many cabinet secretaries to monitor progress. Elsewhere in Washington, it's expected that they will announce sanctions on 10 new Chinese companies for human rights violations in Beijing. And on another front, the G20 finance ministers are expected to endorse the global tax reform proposals, the full details of which have not been worked out yet. There are at least three hurdles that need to be overcome. First is how to redistribute the tax revenue from the largest companies, which seems likely to help other high-income countries rather than developing economies. The second hurdle is the EU and Canadian digital tax, which the US objects to. And third, it's not clear that the tax reforms can pass the US Senate. Back to the markets. Gold was up 0.46% to 1,808. WTI oil was up 2.32% to 74.63, and Bitcoin was up 3.46% at the time of writing to 33,802, and it continues its volatile meanderings. European stocks rebounded after steep losses from the previous session. Concerns over slowing global economic growth, rising Delta cases, and the Fed moving towards tightening monetary policy proved too much for the markets to swallow earlier in the week. Stock indices, which were trading around their all-time highs, came off. key technical levels were tested but not meaningfully breached. As a result, dip buyers were back in on Friday, picking up bargains, hence the rise. The FTSE was up 1.3% to 7,121, while the financials index was up 1.2% to 868.23. The UK's May GDP rose by 0.8%. That's about half of what the median forecast was expecting. And adding insult to injury, April's growth was trimmed to 2% from 2.3%. Industrial output missed expectations, rising by 0.8%, not the 1.4% as projected, and manufacturing output actually fell down 0.1%, although the April decline of 0.3% was actually revised away. Construction disappointed, down 0.8% compared with the 1% forecast, while April's 2% decline was revised to only down 0.7%. Services were a big miss. Instead of expanding by 1.6%, they grew by a more modest 0.9%, and the April surge of 3.4% was slimmed to 2.8%. The data shows the economic rebound started to ease in May, even as the reopening was still in full swing. The UK economy could well do with a leg up. Well, maybe football euphoria could translate into an economic boost, but of course, that won't come till later. A new front in the UK-EU post-Brexit tension has opened. The EU estimates that the UK owes it €47.5 billion for its ongoing commitments to the EU programmes it continues to benefit from and other obligations, including pensions. In 2018, the UK had estimated the obligation would run closer to €41.4 billion. The EU expects a €6.8 billion payment this year. It's also worth noting that Norway's inflation is at elevated levels, which leaves the Norge Bank on course to hike rates later this year. The headline CPI is 2.9% above year-ago levels. That's up from 2.7% in May. The underlying measure, which adjusts for tax changes and excludes energy, slipped to 1.4% from 1.5%. Producer prices jumped 4.6% month over month for a 37.1% year-over-year increase, which notably includes oil prices. The euro-US dollar was up 0.3% to 1.1877. It's struggling to sustain even modest upticks. It settled at 1.1845 yesterday and 1.1865 a week ago. Barring a strong recovery in North America, it will be the fifth losing week in the past six. Sterling was up 0.84% to 1.3901. The DAX rose 1.73% to 15,627, while the German 10-year bond was down 0.34% to minus 0.2930. In Japan, the Nikkei was down 0.63% to 27,940. The Bank of Japan meets next week. With Tokyo in yet another formal state of emergency, it would not be surprising to see it lower its growth forecasts. The BOJ is also expected to provide the broad details of a new lending facility to encourage more environmentally friendly investment. But the BOJ is not expected to take any fresh initiatives to boost the economy, which will likely contract in the quarter that just ended. Talk emerged this week of a new supplemental budget after the Olympics. In Shanghai, the index there slid 0.4% to 3,524 as China's consumer prices rose 1.1% in June, slightly less than expected. This follows a 1.3% year-over-year rise in May. Pork prices were off 36.5% year-over-year, and that took almost 1 percentage point off its CPI measures. There appears to have been a small rebound in pork prices late last month, though, and officials expect prices to stabilise in the second half. Food prices, more generally, fell by 1.7%, compared with a rise of 0.3% in May, and non-food prices rose by a similar magnitude, 1.6% in May. Fuel prices are higher, but the core CPI stripped of food and energy rose 0.9% year over year, the same as May. Producer prices rose 8.8% year over year, compared with 9% in May. And there is some expectation that producer prices increases may have peaked, and officials have signalled further sales of some industrial metals from its strategic stockpiles. The softer inflation readings, coupled with the slippage in the PMI reports, gives impetus to the signal from officials that it is prepared to provide more monetary support. And after mainland markets closed, the PBOC announced a 50 basis point cut in the required reserve ratio, and that will free up about 1 trillion yuan. China also reported a surge in lending in June, led by shadow banking. New yuan bank loans rose by 2.12 trillion yuan, more than a third increase from the 1.5 trillion in May. Aggregate financing, which includes non-bank loans and wealth management arms of banks, jumped to 3.67 trillion from 1.92 trillion in May. While the new yuan loans exceeded expectations by 270 billion yuan, the increase in aggregate financing was 780 billion above the expected forecast. Elsewhere, Drewry's Composite World Container Index increased again, up 4.7% or $397 to 8,795 per 40-foot container, and also remains 333% higher than a year ago. The average composite index for the WCI, assessed by Drewry for year-to-year, is 5,760 per 40-foot container, which is 3,716 higher than the five-year average of $2,044 per 40-foot container. In Australia, the market was hit on Friday amid a global sell-off of risk assets, spiked by concerns the global economic recovery could be derailed by the rising number of COVID-19 cases linked to the infectious Delta strain. Plus, of course, New South Wales was forced to extend its lockdown restrictions for a further week in order to combat a rising number of local cases associated with the strain. The ASX 200 closed on Friday down 0.93% to 7,273 and ended the week 0.5% lower, while the financials index slid 0.9% to 6,418. A tech-led sell-off on Friday dragged the Australian share market lower for the week as investors retreated from risky assets with the spread of the Delta variant of COVID-19, both domestically and locally, fueling fears the economic recovery could stall. Afterpay Touch, for example, fell 4.97% to 117.51. The major banks led the market losses this week. CBA fell 0.9% to 98.59. ANZ declined 1.7% to 27.85. Westpac dipped 1.1% to 25.37. The NAB closed 0.6% lower to 26.08. A number of other blue chips were also dragged lower through the week. Wesfarmers fell 1.7% to $58. Macquarie Group slid 1.7% to $154.19. And Telstra dropped 1.1% to $3.75. Crown Resorts was also hit hard, falling 7.8% to $10.99 after the Royal Commission into the company revealed it may have shortchanged the state government as much as $200 million. And it also said it expects to post a loss this financial year, driven by costs associated with lockdowns and two royal commissions. The major iron ore miners supported the market, though, as the price of the bulk commodity rose above $220 a ton. BHP Group rose 1.9% to $49.48, and Fortescue Metals firmed 1.2% to $23.87. But Rio Tinto dropped slightly, 0.2% down to $125.40. Sydney Airport roared 33% to $7.73 this week after receiving an unsolicited $22 billion takeover bid from a consortium of investors including IFM Investors, Queensland Superannuation Fund QSuper, and US-based Global Infrastructure Partners. A consortium led by Macquarie Group was also reported considering a rival offer. Auckland Airport also traded higher on that news, rising 4.2% to $6.98. And Challenger climbed 6.7% to 588 after Bermuda-based life assurance company Athene brought a long-held 15% stake in the annuities provider from Sydney-based fund manager Caledonia Investments on Wednesday for $720 million. And finally, English folk hero Robin Hood took from the rich and gave to the poor. But whether free trading app Robin Hood could legitimately make the same claim is up for the debate. Its prospective filing ahead of a $40 billion float lifts the lid on its checkered history and set of operating practices which arguably gives as much to the rich as they save the poor. Robin Hood's free brokerage saves its 17.7 million monthly users significant fees, but The prospect also reveals how Robinhood is hooked on the murky practice of selling retail order flow to market makers for revenue. In January to March, 81% of its $522.2 million total revenue was from transaction rebates or selling order flow. The practice of selling retail traders' orders to market makers who match bids and offer prices instead of exchanges is not controversial for nothing. The US Securities and Exchange Commission fined Robinhood $65 million last December for providing its users inferior at-market trade prices that deprive them of $34.1 million net of the free brokerage savings. In theory, then, a market maker not executing trades at the best available price could execute a $1,000 sell order at a price 2.5% inferior to the market and cost a novice trader $25 out of sight, which is far more than a standard brokerage fee of around $10. While Robinhood neither admitted nor denied the charges, the picture of taking from the poor to give itself and the Wall Street's rich is ugly. Moreover, the wild minute-by-minute swings in meme stocks, popular with novice traders such as GameStop and AMC, arguably amplifies the opportunity for Robinhood users placing at-market orders to receive inferior prices if historical failings repeat. Plus, of course, massive amounts of volatility. Today, Robinhood says its payment for order flow model provides a net benefit to users as market makers often obtain better prices than exchanges. And any investor can also extinguish best execution risks by placing an at limit order with the US National's best bid and offer mechanism designed to guarantee investors the best quoted price at trade time. But still, Robinhood's unique model among budget brokers leaves it vulnerable to any new legislation limiting payments for order flow and materially reducing its main source of revenue. Now, the US market structure of dozens of market makers and exchanges creating more liquidity has lowered transaction costs for US investors, but in Australia, the best execution obligations are covered under ASIC's Regulatory Guide 265, with just the ASX and Chi-X offering visible market depth and prices. Some market makers provide off-market dark pools of liquidity matching trades. Initially, regulators allowed these dark pools on the basis they helped match large block trades, but they've evolved to be dominated by tiny trades as a result of algorithms programmed to break large orders into small orders or to profit from high-frequency trading. Accusations that the growth of dark pools have contributed to the widening of bid-offer spreads with negative effects on price formation and discovery for retail investors have not been seriously acted on by the regulators. Dark pool traders can also jump queues ahead of retail investors on lit exchanges, often in highly liquid shares like Telstra, where you have hundreds of retail traders sitting on a bid price of 1 or 2 cents below the offer price. The close shop nature of Australia's market means brokerage costs remain higher for retail investors, although budget brokers like Selfwealth, Superhero, and Stake do want to change that. But my point is that these dark pools absolutely mean that most retail share traders are actually not getting the best possible prices, cannot see market depth, and are therefore second-class citizens, and are still paying way, way too much. And once again, the regulators are asleep. How many times have I had to say that in recent times? I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.